From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. If you are a believer in the cult of President Donald Trump, you may be under the impression that the COVID-19 pandemic is just about wrapping up, and everything is, in Trump's words, totally under control. But more than 215,000 Americans have died from the disease, and more deaths continue to pile up. The massive failures of the Trump administration in tackling the pandemic are so numerous and shocking that it took a two-hour investigative documentary to chronicle them. The film, Totally Under Control, was made with great difficulty and secrecy during the pandemic and released before the crisis is over, featuring interviews with such people as the federal government scientist and whistleblower, Dr. Rick Bright, former Obama administration HHS head Kathleen Sebelius, and many others. The film paints a damning portrait of the repeated failures of the Trump White House to control a virus it should have been failure.
The CDC has identified a case of coronavirus in Washington State. The words about a pandemic at this point?
No, we're not at all, and it's going to be just fine. Whatever happens, we're totally prepared.
The scientists knew what to do for the pandemic response. The plan was in front of us, but leadership would not do it. It is time to lay our careers on the line and push back.
It's clear the United States did not perform to the best of its ability with the coronavirus.
Went wrong for us.
The truth is that political leaders caused avoidable death and destruction.
The scientists sounded the alarm every day. The U.S. government was doing nothing.
And that's the trailer for the documentary Totally Under Control, out now on demand on digital platforms and available on Hulu starting October 20th. My guests are Alex Gibney, writer and director of Totally Under Control. He is an Academy Award-winning filmmaker best known for his 2007 film about the Afghanistan war called Taxi to the Dark Side. His other films include Enron, The Smartest Guys in the Room, and Going Clear, Scientology and the Prison of Belief. Also joining us are Suzanne Hillinger and Ophelia Harutunyan, co-directors of Totally Under Control. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So I'd like to start with a question about how this whole project came to start and finish in such a short period of time. You three were making a documentary in real time about a disaster that's unfolding in real time and that isn't even over yet. So I imagine that the challenges of making a film like this were perhaps greater than something you might have done before.
It was hugely challenging. And, you know, it started back in April. I was living in New Jersey. My office had been in New York and, you know, was deeply disturbed about the federal response and people I knew who had, and people I knew had died from the virus. So it seemed important to do something about that federal response. Though I think even then I felt that the focus should be on the early days. And the early days then, with as fast as the 24/7 news cycle moves, that the early days would actually end up being a kind of moment in history of when all of this might have been or could have been avoided. So that was the focus. And then I desperately needed collaborators, full collaborators. And so that's when I reached out to Suzanne and Ophelia, and it was really in May that we started.
So the challenges of filming during a pandemic were also apparent. You addressed that right in the beginning of the documentary where you discuss how you have your sort of remote camera units. But the people that you managed to convince to speak on screen were some of them were from the highest levels who had been in high levels of government, who had resigned in frustration, who had been in previous administrations. And it seemed as though many of them were sort of speaking out because they really, truly felt compelled to, and not necessarily because it had anything to do with their political affiliation.
Right. I think a lot of people had seen a lot of incompetence and they realized that the incompetence had cost a lot of lives, and they felt it was important to speak up. And obviously, it's not easy to come forward in any administration, but especially in this administration. And I think we were very thankful that they did speak up and they did the interviews for the American public to see.
Tell me about the decision around bringing the comparison with South Korea. This is a country of about 50 plus million people, so much smaller than the United States. Why was that an important juxtaposition?
I think it was important for two reasons. One was there was a kind of a starting gate. And in both countries, the first COVID patient was discovered on the same day, January 20th. So if you're going on a timeline, you know, the starting line is the same for both countries. But just as important, without a comparison, it would have been too easy to look at the U.S. federal response and for some people, particularly in this country, to conclude that, oh, it just happened. We were overwhelmed. There was nothing we could have done. If you compare it with somebody with another country, which was, yes, smaller than the United States, but heavily urbanized, and 51 million people is quite a big number. So, you know, how did they respond? And did they make different decisions that we could have made that would have made a difference? So that comparison ended up being, I think, terribly important to avoid any mistaken conclusion that this was unavoidable. It was clearly avoidable.
Right. So the key question was how many people died unnecessarily? So it seemed as though that lost month early in the year was critical, and your film honed in on that. And Suzanne, maybe you can address this issue. A lot of it ended up focusing around a flawed test that was sent to public labs around the country. And once it was found that the tests were flawed, everything came to a grinding halt. Mysteriously?
Yeah, I mean, I think that in January, everything seemed to be going well. The CDC was developing a test. And, you know, so far we had been there before in response to other epidemics. But yeah, there was an error in the test. I think it was a contamination issue. And at the moment when we so desperately needed tests, we needed to be able to understand how this virus was spreading across the country, who was sick, who was, you know, getting sick over other people, really trying to just understand the virus. Testing was going to be so crucial. And when they realized that there was a problem, at this point, there was a working test that the WHO was distributing to other countries. It was developed in a German lab. You know, we could have pivoted to that test. The government also could have started collaborating with private labs who were also capable of developing a test like this. And they didn't. And that, I think, could have been a decision made within the CDC of we need help. It could have been a decision made at the top, HHS, hey, we need to pivot. It could have gone all the way to the top. And, you know, the president could have said, this is a crisis. We need to, you know, change things up really fast. Somebody needed to have a creative solution. Nobody did. We still don't know the intricate details of the conversations that led to not having another solution. But what we do know is that, you know, almost a month later, they just removed one of the three assays, one of the three tools they used to do the test. And kept the old test.
Which could have happened. They could have done that right at the moment when they discovered the flaw, and we would have regained that lost month.
Yes.
Exactly.
Ophelia, let me ask you this. One of the things the Trump administration has touted over and over again is that it banned travel from China as the reason why 2 million people haven't died in the U.S. and 200,000 have, and they've touted that as a great success. But the film also tackles the fact that there was a ban on travel from Europe, but that ban was enacted without a plan, and that may have been what ended up fueling the pandemic in striking New York City? Can you go through that a little bit?
Honestly, both travel bans didn't have a plan attached. Even the China ban, I mean, you can say it was the right decision, but it had a lot of loopholes, right? A lot of Americans came back from China bringing the virus with them. They were not tested at the airports. They were not quarantined. So they kind of came back and went on living their lives. I know also that there were also some other loopholes where you could go to Hong Kong and or Europe and come from there. So it didn't really help. I mean, it might have helped a small percentage wise, but I think the issue was that even if the travel ban from China was the right move, we should have followed that, you know, with rigorous testing and contact tracing, and we weren't doing anything to actually see the virus because it was already in the United States. The virus wasn't, you know, just coming from the outside. It was already spreading in the country. The travel ban from Europe came much later. And at that point, the virus was already in most of the states in America. I was one of the people returning from Europe. I had to buy a last minute, very expensive ticket when the ban came out. And I didn't know what that meant, it was there were so many unknowns, and I rushed to come back, and I was not screened at the airport. I returned 2 hours before the ban went into effect. I was not screened. I didn't sign anything. I didn't get any information. No one called me later to, I don't know, do any contract tracing. So that was just a glimpse of when I saw that, and I saw the crowds at the airport. I genuinely was worried that this was going to be bad. I don't think it's accurate to say that the people returning from Europe in mid-March were the ones who brought the virus to New York. I think the virus had already spread to New York, but we definitely, I can certainly say that it must have made it worse, just because, again, people were returning and a lot of young people were asymptomatic, so it was hard to tell who had the virus and who didn't.
Right. I guess I'm going from some of the news reports or studies of those who were impacted in New York City and the virus, the strain of the virus that they caught being traced to Europe rather than China, but that aspect wasn't necessarily tackled in the film. Alex, let me ask you about what seems to be the most shocking aspect of the film, if you judge by the media coverage of your documentary, which is Jared Kushner's role in all of this. He's the president's advisor and son-in-law. And tell me about the whistleblower that you spoke with, a young man who was one of the many 20-something-year-olds that were recruited by Kushner to purchase PPE. This was truly one of the most shocking aspects of the film.
It was shocking. And I consider myself a student of corruption. And this made my jaw drop. The whistleblower you're referring to is Max Kennedy Jr. He's the grandson, actually, of Robert Kennedy. He and nine other, young 20-year-olds, 23-24-year-olds, all volunteered to help Jared Kushner's task force to try to find PPE all over the world. And Jared Kushner's task force was presented with a huge, a blare of trumpets, as if they were really going to get the job done. And they go down to Washington, and they're ready to roll up their sleeves, and they assume that their job is going to be to get coffee, to do data entry, to help whatever robust, experienced team in procurement and distribution is in place at FEMA. Well, they soon learned that, in fact, there was no team in place in FEMA at all. They were the team. These 10 kids who were supposed to use their own laptops and their own cell phones and just start, Googling for information about where they might find PPE all over the world. That was the plan. That was Jared Kushner's plan. And even worse than that, it turned out there was an incredible degree of corruption. That the Trump administration sort of appointed five companies to be the custodians of some of the deals that were negotiated by Max's team, and it was subsidized to some extent by the federal government. But these companies then could charge whatever they wanted, and at least for 50% of their N95 masks, which they were supposedly trying to get to desperately needed places like hospitals, you know, for doctors and nurses who were in harm's way, they could sell them anywhere. They didn't have to sell them to hotspots. They could even sell them to other countries. So it was the most discombobulated, ineffective, corrupt system imaginable. And Max Kennedy gives us eyes on that from the inside, just sitting there being asked by this administration to do the best he could. And
I understand he had to break his NDA to speak out.
He did.
Yeah, which is what made him a whistleblower, I guess. Yeah,
he did. Yeah. He did. And he conveyed some of that information to Congress and also anonymously early on. We were sort of looking for him, even as he was looking for us, because he had given some of that information anonymously to the New York Times and the Washington Post.
Suzanne, let's talk more about the N95 masks. If you or I today wanted to, you know, purchase one just individually, you know, it is October, many months after the virus, the pandemic was declared. One, you know, ought to imagine that living in the United States, so many months into this disaster, that, okay, now might be a good time that if one individual wanted to purchase an N95 mask, you could maybe go to Amazon or wherever. They're still not available. And I understand that there's still a shortage. And this is such a huge aspect of it because we had at least one manufacturer in the United States who was waiting for the government to place an order. And you spoke with him in your film. Tell me about that aspect of the story. So shocking, especially considering we have an administration in place that has continuously said, make America great again, and didn't take advantage of an American manufacturer of these critical masks.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I don't know if we totally know why somebody like Michael Bowen wasn't called upon by the government to make these masks. He was, waiting for orders, and that it didn't happen. And simultaneously, I mean, I'd venture to say, and Alex, you should jump in and correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like there's been a history of, you know, the government seeking out these partnerships in China. And there were a lot of, Chinese mask makers that they were making deals with to get masks to come here. I mean, I personally don't have enough information to know exactly why that happened, but I don't know, Alex, do you want to?
Well, I would just amplify what Suzanne said, which is that, in theory, Trump came into power as a kind of America first guy. And Mike Bowen, who's running this mask maker in Texas, appealed both to the Obama administration, but also clearly to the Trump administration, said, give me orders and I will start, putting my factory at your disposal 24/7. But they never got the orders. And indeed, there was a period where we were literally early on, where we were literally shipping American-made masks to China. And so when it came time that we desperately needed them, we had a shortage and we ended up having to pay 10 times the price for mass imported for China. So it was just a complete abdication of what Trump said he wanted to do economically, but also just an example of complete incompetence.
I'm just going to add one thing. Sorry, I was just going to add one thing. I think it's important to remember that when Mike Bowen was sending these emails to Rick Bright and people in the administration, this was January, February, the administration knew enough to know that they're going to need N95 masks, and they did not take up on his calls, right? It's important to understand the timeline of events that we from the Woodward tapes, we already know, right? That that Trump, the president, early February knew how dangerous the virus was, that it was a respiratory virus, that means we're going to need masks. And it is, I think it is criminal to not have taken up on these emails and exhilarated the.
And so let me ask about one very perplexing part of this whole thing, which I really feel like I learned a lot from your documentary, or it seemed to somehow make a little bit more sense. And this is the mystery around hydroxychloroquine. And I'll throw out the question, maybe Ophelia or Alex or Suzanne, any one of you, as much as you want to give away about what the documentary shares, about why the Trump administration fixated on hydroxychloroquine. I mean, at first it felt to me that he must have some financial stake in all of this, but I don't think that's necessarily true, is it?
I think that was everyone's first kind of instinct to look into any financial, you know, to see if he has any connections to it. But it actually is a generic drug. It costs $10. So it wouldn't. And I don't think to this date anyone has been able to find any financial connections. But it really, I think what we've come up with an explanation is just the magical thinking of the president, hoping that this drug was just going, someone told him that, hey, this could be a solution, and he kind of clinged to it, and he just was hoping that this was going to be the drug that is going to save his presidency.
And you spoke with the doctor, Zelenko, who made a YouTube video appealing to the president that seems to have been the start of this whole thing?
There were multiple things that started this conversation. As we mentioned in the film, Elon Musk had tweeted a study that was done, and then Fox News kind of picked up on the news, and then the president started talking about it, and Dr. Zelenko himself also had watched some YouTube videos that had talked about, you know, the possible strength of these three drugs together. And so when Dr. Zelenko made this video addressed to Trump, that kind of was another added kind of confirmation, at least for the administration, that, hey, here's a doctor that is using these drugs and is getting good results, as he's saying. So he immediately got contacted by the chief of staff and then the FDA commissioner, which was, again, you know, goes to show that if when the administration wanted something done quickly, they would immediately get on it because that's what the president wanted. But when, you know, we were having issues with testing, for a month, testing was stalled and no one really cared to do anything about it.
And of course, interestingly, we now know. Yes, go ahead, Alex.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
We now know that, of course, the president himself got COVID, and this was revealed, I believe, a day after your film was completed. But he didn't take hydroxychloroquine.
No.
He says he did. I doubt he did, but he says he did.
Well, he did before. Right. Oh, he claimed to take it as a preventative.
Right. Correct. Yeah, that's right.
Exactly.
So let me throw this question to all three of you, starting with you, Alex, which is that it seems as though the Trump administration and President Trump's main goal right from the start of this was to ensure that the economy didn't fail, because that was his ticket to re-election. The pandemic got in the way of that. And so he tried to focus on the economy and not the virus. But in the end, it seems as though focusing on the economy and not the virus ended up being the worst possible decision for the economy and for the virus.
You said it. I mean, if you think about it, if the Trump administration had focused on the threat of the virus, all the economic damage could have been contained. And the classic example is South Korea. That we compare the U.S. response to the South Korean response. Korea never had to shut down its economy in the way that we did, because they moved quickly to contain the virus, which we never did do. And so by ignoring the virus in hoping magically that it wouldn't affect the economy, it ended up destroying the economy.
I think also to piggyback off that, you know, this idea that, and it was one of, you know, Trump's campaign speeches going in when he was running for president the first time, that, you know, he would fix the economy and that he would, you know, run the US government the same way that he ran all of his successful businesses, and that he would run the government like a business. And what we've really all experienced is the effects of that. This is what happens when somebody prioritizes economy first. This is what happens when somebody, you know, lets go of a lot of career politicians, career scientists, and puts in place a bunch of other business folk to make decisions when they don't understand how the government runs, when they don't necessarily have the best of intentions of Americans, but also have their eyes on the, you know, the economy. We've all sort of been victim to that through this pandemic.
Also, he was a terrible businessman. I mean, let's be honest. The net result of most of his businesses was bankruptcy. He became an expert in how to manipulate banks because he owed so much money to the banks that he controlled the banks instead of the banks controlling him. So, you know, if it hadn't been for The Apprentice, he would have been a completely failed businessman. And The Apprentice was simply a mechanism for monetizing celebrity. And frankly, that's how he develops real estate properties. He just attaches his name.
And so finally, the whole perfect storm that ended up resulting in this disaster with 200,000 plus Americans dying seems to be a classic example of what we don't want to happen. When you have a government that's sort of driven by a sort of libertarian economic approach, which is government is bad, let the private market do its job. None of that works when you're in a situation where there is a pandemic, where there's a disaster that requires government intervention. And so we had, at precisely the moment when we needed a strong government intervention, we had people in power who believed the exact opposite. And your film shows time after time where they wanted so badly for the private market to come to the rescue, but of course it can't, and it didn't.
Yeah, and when Jared Kushner said that, you know, the national stockpile was our stockpile and not the state stockpile, everyone was confused about that statement, because the whole idea of the national stockpile was to distribute to the states. And so that goes to show that they really didn't think that the federal government had a role in this pandemic, that the states should be on their own. And obviously that's very dangerous, and that's the states do not have the capacity that the federal government does, right? The federal government can, have all these contracts with suppliers and get better prices and has the ability to put bigger orders, and the states don't have all of these capabilities, but the states were left on their own to deal with this pandemic, which, you know, clearly right. It is what it is. We were still seeing the results of that.
Well, I want to thank the three of you so much for joining us today. Alex Gibney, Suzanne Hillinger, Ophelia Hartunian. Thank you so much. And we'll, of course, give out information about how people can watch your documentary. Good luck to you.
Thank you so much.
My guests have been the Academy Award-winning documentarian Alex Gibney, writer and director of the new film Totally Under Control, and his two co-directors on the film, Suzanne Hillinger and Ophelia Hartunian. You can stream the film on demand right now or watch it on Hulu starting October 20th. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.